Hello and welcome again to another edition of Lost in Science. This is half an hour of sciencey talking on your radio or somewhere thereabouts, and we're here every week. Who are we? My name is Stu, and with me on the show this week, I have Lyndon.
G'day, Stu. How are you going? How are you feeling? You feeling sciencey today?
I'm feeling pretty sciencey. Yeah. How about you? What have you brought in for us this week?
Well, this week, you know, things are starting to warm up. If you're in the southern states, things are probably technically still in the cooler part of the year if you're in the northern states. But in the southern states, things are starting to look a little bit warmer, a little bit springier. So I thought I'd have a chat with someone that cares a lot about our plants. And he cares about the plants, particularly in relation to how they support our buzzy little critters, how they support our native bees and our native insects. I'm very excited about the chat I've got this week because it's with Clancy Lester, who is the bee man himself. He is a young guy. He grew up in country Victoria, and he's really made this career for himself online supporting native bees, basically native bees and native insects. He builds bee hotels that he sells. He runs workshops for kindergarten all the way through to aged care centers. And he's all over the place at the moment. So I feel very lucky to be able to secure a chat with him. We're going to be talking about the beauty of our native insects, how much trouble they're in, and how we can support them. Yeah, which is a pretty valuable thing to do.
Absolutely. And Clancy is a supporter of our show as well, because he gave us a bee hotel as a prize at our recent trivia night. So yay, Clancy.
Exactly. Thanks. Big fan of the show. It's very,
yeah.
The least we could do to get him in and hear about all the cool stuff that he's doing. So big thanks to Clancy for the bee hotel that's currently sitting on my front porch waiting to be collected by the winner.
I hope nobody moves into it while it's waiting for collection.
You get bonus bees.
Yeah, you relocate them across the city somehow, but yeah.
What about you, Stu? What have you got for us this week?
Well, I was reading an article about figuring out one of the big questions, and this is probably a bit related to what Clancy does, is about biodiversity. We don't really know what sort of biodiversity there used to be, so we don't really have anything to compare our current levels of biodiversity to. We've got vague ideas of what used to be around, but I was just thinking about how do we keep track of living things, of biodiversity, and the numbers of creatures around and creatures are around. What are the best ways we've got to measure them? So I thought I'd dive into that a little bit, and there's a whole bunch of ways we look for signs of life in the world. But me being a sci-fi fan, the reason that I started thinking about it was because of Star Trek. And on Star Trek, one of the things they often say is scan for life signs. And I thought, that's a cool thing to be able to do. Just scan for life signs and we'll just see what's there. But obviously, you know, we don't live in Star Trek, so we've got to actually have better ways of doing it. Not yet, not yet. But we're working towards it. We should get on with the show because people want to hear the stories and not just hear the intro. So let's get on with it now.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Lost in Science, and today I have with me the man himself, the bee man, Clancy Lester. How are you, Clancy? Nice to have you on the show.
I'm great, Lyndon. Thanks for having me on here. It's really exciting to talk about native bees once again.
Talk about native bees once again? I mean, what else is there to talk about? You've been talking about them for how long? How long have you been talking about native bees?
Oh, probably at least a couple of years now, ever since I sort of started learning about them myself.
Tell me then, you are
You're a force. You're a force of nature. I'm not going to lie. It's a great privilege to have you on the show. But I'm interested to hear how you got to where you are. What made you decide, this is what I'm going to do?
It's probably couldn't be broken up into more than just the one main thing. I think it started off with the fact that nobody knew about or nobody knows about how insects are declining. And that was one thing when I started learning about through my research up in Northeast Arnhem Land with the Yolngu people, that nobody in the general public even knows native bees exist or that insects are declining around the world. Like, one thing I say to get people to realise that is, when's the last time you cleaned bugs off your windscreen? We used to do that all the time if we went on a road trip, and nobody seems to do that anymore. And then I think just probably the other thing has just been the support when I sort of started out and I was like so little and just reaching a few people, but those few people were so encouraging, and that really made me want to, you know, invest my time and energy into really advocating and investing in it and reaching for the sky.
How do you go about advocating for the bees?
Oh, there's a whole heap range of different things. So there's things like when people want to sign petitions to get, you know, remnant habitat protected from housing development, and trying to get people involved in stopping that from happening, or trying to get people to encourage native wildlife in their local backyard or local parks and reserves by planting native plants, and all these sorts of little things that do seem to add up when a whole bunch of people are doing it as a collective.
But you're also doing work on your own, right? You build bee hotels that you sell to people, and you also run workshops. Is that right? What sort of audiences are you reaching with the workshops that you run?
Well, those audiences of the workshops start at about 2 or 3 years old.
Oh,
even been to early learning centres, because kids can still get their hands dirty and mix clay and sand together for the ground nesting bees, or they can put cut up bits of bamboo in tin cans. So up from 2 or 3 up to, I think, the oldest I reckon I've had is maybe about mid-80s. I've had some oldies at gardening clubs. So I have a very wide range of people that show up for native bees and want to get involved.
You mentioned ground-dwelling bees or ground-nesting bees. I didn't realise that they existed. Where do they live?
Yeah,
apart from in the ground.
Yeah, so the blue banner bee, which is when I say, do you know if native bees exist? The very few people that do know of native bees have heard of the blue banner bee, and that is a ground nesting bee. So they will dig their nest down into clay and sandy soils, or along riverbanks where there's a bit of a cliff face, and that's why sometimes you'll get them in the mortar in between your bricks in a mud brick house. Mm-hmm. About 70% of our 2,000 species of native bees will nest in the ground.
Wow, that's amazing. Wait, how many species of native bees did you say we had?
I said we had over 2,000 species. So the currently accepted number is 1,717 officially described species, but we have some sitting in museum drawers, some that have been collected and haven't even been sent in yet, and we've still got some to find. So they said at least 2,000 when we get them all.
Sounds like a much more fun version of Pokemon Go, when we get them all. Do you think that's possible? Do you think we'll be able to identify all the native bees?
Australia's a very big place, and we've got some pretty remote areas where the bees would still exist. Even in the middle of the harshest deserts, there's still some bees that are hanging around.
This is maybe an offensive question, and I apologise if I offend you, but I mean, what do native bees offer that the standard bee that we see around, not the blue-banded bee, but your standard bee, what do native bees offer that this, I assume that's an introduced bee,
yep,
European bee, what do our native bees do that European introduced bees do not?
So the European bees are a great pollinator, and it'll pollinate a lot of exotic plants and a lot of native plants. But it is limited into what some of the specialist relationships, which Australia, as such an isolated continent for millions of years, we've had such a lengthy period of time where native wasps and native flies and native bees have developed these specialist relationships between the native plants that they pollinate. And so you see these intricate structures, which, like, there's this native moth that pollinates baronies that has this little pollen collecting structure on its abdomen, or you have native bees which are capable of buzz pollinating, which European honeybees can't do, where they'll literally shake the flower by vibrating their wings for flight, but they don't actually flap their wings. Their body just shakes and they'll release the pollen from buzz pollinated plants. Wow. And so there's so many of these really amazing specialist relationships which are not replaceable by a European honeybee.
So then what role do the bee hotels in particular have then? Is that one of the main sources of stress for these, for many of these species, that they don't have anywhere to live?
Yeah, in an urban environment, because when you think about, say, like a park or garden near your home, you think some of the places where native bees love to nest in, like in the natural environment, they love to nest in bare, open clay or sandy soils, and they love to nest in the holes on in wood boring holes from grubs in dead tree stumps or dead logs, or they love to nest in the hollows from, say, like the cuttings of old dead flowers that are hollow or pithy stemmed, or the bamboo or reeds and things which have died. And so if you think about your local park, the second there's a tree branch that falls over, gets taken away and cleared off, all of the bare open ground is covered by mulch. So a lot of the natural nesting sites for native bees don't really exist in an urban environment. And so we can provide supplementary habitat with these bee hotels.
You said that when you first started out, sort of process after you finished your training, you have a master's in, what's it called, entomology?
It had a bit of everything. I can't really call myself an entomologist because there's some bee nerds and bug nerds that would just out nerd me. So can't really quite claim that, I reckon.
Okay, I'm not gonna ask you to reel off a bunch of scientific names here. But you said you had a lot of support when you first started. Does that extend to local councils and local community groups that could possibly reverse some of these decisions that are made about cleaning up potential bee habitats and insect habitats?
Yeah, and this is one thing which I've really enjoyed about having my platform is when I've seen like local councils that have had petitions, or they've had people ask things at question time during council meetings, or they've launched campaigns towards getting approval for things like planting native plants and flowers in their nature strips instead of the standard grass, which is a monoculture and not supportive of any biodiversity. And so there's been these things that have gone through councils that have actually changed through like community engagement and community advocation.
Wow. And you went to Parliament not that long ago as well.
Yeah, been to Parliament as a ABC trailblazer. So that was for initiatives run by youth in regional and rural communities. And so I got a lot of support from the ABC for marketing and online reach and social media, which was really handy. And also getting the chance to talk to politicians and put it in the back of their mind what they should be really looking after.
It's wonderful to have people going to that grass-covered hill. Did you start a bit of a petition to replace that with some native plants?
Yeah, I definitely did. We filmed a video with ABC News sitting on the front lawn of Parliament and talking about how it would look much better with natives. Yeah,
that's
great. I think that one has like over 500,000 views on that.
Wow.
Yeah, so a few people were agreeing.
You have gone further afield as well, right, than Parliament House. You recently came back from South America.
Yep, I wanted to go to South America. It's always a dream of mine. I grew up a David Attenborough, Steve Irwin, obsessed kid, loved watching National Geographic, and the Amazon is one of those places that just holds such an amazing array of biodiversity, particularly insects in some of the parts. And I just wanted to go over there and find as many cool bugs as I could, and cool bugs I found.
How do they compare to the native insects?
I think it's hard to compare any of the native bees we have here with the orchid bees in South America. They're called orchid bees because the male wants to smell as good as possible for the ladies. So they go to orchids and collect the perfumes and try and smell as good as they can. And they are just the most shiny metallic greens and blues and pink colours you've ever seen. It's just amazing.
Apart from the orchid bee, what would you say, we must get this question all the time, particularly from the 2 and 3 year olds, what's your favourite Australian insect?
Oh, wow. I think that definitely up there would be the cuckoo bee.
What's a cuckoo bee?
So that's similar to the cuckoo bird. Mm-hmm. It's a parasitic animal. So it's a kleptoparasite or a pollen stealer. And what all everything about its evolution is designed to parasitizing the blue banded bee. So it has so many cool adaptations. So it has similar colors so it can sneak in the nest undetected, and it has overdeveloped mandibles of the larvae when it's only just a grub, so that they're capable of killing the blue banded bee baby if the blue banded bee egg hatches. And everything about them is just designed to parasitize the blue banded bee. Yeah. And they're also just incredible bright blue neon colors as well. They're definitely one of my favorites.
Oh, okay.
But that's such a hard question to answer because about a million things come to my mind though.
Where can you find the cuckoo bee?
Wherever you can find the blue banded bee. So in most parts of Australia apart from Tasmania.
And the blue banded bee, what time of year is the best time to look for the blue banded bee?
Probably towards the end of spring and into the summertime. There, and then through to early autumn.
Most insects are active in the warmer months. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, quite a few, particularly native bees. A lot of our native bees won't see them flying around in the winter time, and that's because throughout the winter time they often exist in their life cycles as grubs and pupae.
If people want to find out more about you, book a workshop or order a bee hotel, where can they find you, Clancy?
So I'm on social media at beesandblossoms.oz, and that's where you can find me. And I also have a website, nativebeehotels.com. So if you want to learn any cool facts about bees or see some cool bugs and the videos I make about Indigenous knowledge and that sort of thing, feel free to follow along or learn how to build a bee hotel as well.
beesandblossoms.oz. Thanks for joining us, Clancy, on Lost in Science.
Thanks for having me on, Lyndon.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far? Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Yes, you are listening to Lost in Science. I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but I'm always ready to put science in the context of science fiction. Whenever there's some sort of relevance, or when there's no relevance whatsoever, I'll just throw it in there.
You'll shoehorn a famous shoehorner.
Yeah. but having grown up watching science fiction, you know, watching Doctor Who and Star Trek as a kid, it definitely had an influence on my life choices, on my career choices potentially, as well as highlighting what we can and can't do in real life. Even though I think, you know, a lot of technology is inspired by science fiction and vice versa, it's sort of like they both feed off each other, art imitating science and back and forth. But one thing that I said in the intro that's often done in spacefaring science fiction is the search for and discovery of life forms, you know, friendly and unfriendly, human-shaped or otherwise, all over the solar system and the galaxy and in time and space. And a phrase often heard, as I said before, in various incarnations of Star Trek is the instruction to scan for life signs. They get that instruction, just scan for life signs, which means, by some technological means, the crew are capable of detecting living things indirectly.
I always assumed it was with heat, like body heat.
I mean, that would be kind of, I mean, scan for life signs. It's like you can go and look out the window. You're still scanning for life signs if that's what you're doing. Looking for gangs, for example, out the window, you might be scanning for life signs. But how that works in Star Trek is basically down to the magic of television and the lack of peer review in script writing. In real life, there are a few things we can do that make it not inconceivable. The first obvious thing, like you've just said, Lindo, is we look for heat. Most living things that we know of generate heat. They're exothermic by nature. They generate heat just by metabolizing, just by being alive. They're making some heat. But it doesn't tell you a lot about it. It says there's something there. Could be someone's left the heater on. Mm. You know, it's not really very accurate. You can find living things with heat sensing technology that we already have. It already exists, that sort of thing. We could look for other indirect signs of life. So they, in Aliens and other films, they build detectors that pick up very slight fluctuations in air pressure, which I've got to be honest, seems a little bit less reliable than heat. Picking up fluctuations in air pressure, I don't know why you would think that was a great way to look for an alien that's trying to eat your face.
No, but that's a thunderstorm. That's what you find in there.
That's right. There's weather on these planets, right? So, you know, at a distance, heat is still probably more useful than fluctuations in air pressure. But even that relies on a level of proximity that's not always achievable or desirable. So are there ways of detecting life at much greater distances than being able to measure heat signatures? Well, we know, and we've even talked about this on the show, one of the things scientists looking at exoplanets do is look for evidence of gases associated with living things. Methane is one example that they have looked for and found. They can detect that over huge distances with spectrometry and looking at, you know, the way light travels through different substances, and they can figure out what's there and what's not there. But, you know, things like methane is not a very good indicator of something being alive. It's an indicator that there's methane. And we know that methane can be produced by things that are not alive. There's methane all over the place. There's organic chemicals all over the solar system, at least, and if very likely all over the galaxy. You know, things like methane and other organic compounds are found in all sorts of places which don't have any living things present.
So that's more of a sign that something was there, something was alive?
Well, possibly, or possibly, you know, there are organic chemicals that are not made by living things as well. They're just organic chemicals because they're part of organic chemistry, which is not really anything at all. Even things like formaldehyde, they've found formaldehyde on comets and things like that, which means, you know, we would think of it as an organic chemical, but it's not from an organic source. It's not from a living thing necessarily. One molecule that we're aware of that is present in every living thing that we know of on Earth, which is all the living things we know of, is called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, which is found in all living cells. So ATP is essential for energy transfer within and between cells, directly involved in multiple cellular processes. It's actually been called the molecular unit of currency because of its role in energy accounting. So when you're looking at energy accounts in living things, the ATP levels is what you're tracking the whole way through to figure out where the energy is going and how it's being used. Interestingly, if traces of ATP are found, it's likely there's something living very close by or something that was very recently alive. So we know this is a substance which is made by living things and used by living things all the time. If you find it, there's something there.
So how do you find it then?
Well, so basically we use this all the time. It's a reliable trace of life. It's commonly used to detect contamination in food production and in medical industries where sterility is a top priority. Basically, you swab a surface, it activates with the ATP, and then you shine an ultraviolet light over it, and it luminesces. And that's what they're doing in those, you know, cop shows where they're looking for traces with the black lights.
Oh, they're looking for ATP. Oh, I thought they were looking for something very different.
Well, I mean, you know, there's in proteins, there's traces of ATP, so it could be just about anything. So what it comes down to, a simple swab of a surface or a sample of a material like a food, you can check for the presence of ATP. It's a very simple pass or fail test. It's either there or it's not. Great way of scanning it for life. Now, all of these things can tell us about the presence of something that's alive, but they don't really tell us much about what we are detecting, just that we're detecting something with a metabolism, basically. So it could be anything from a bacteria all the way up to an elephant. Hopefully you would notice the elephant, but, you know, you're looking at traces here.
They might have their nails painted red in a strawberry bush. You don't know.
That's right. Disguised. The famous disguise of the elephant in the strawberry patch. But most living things, especially larger multicellular organisms, leave traces of cells and other tissue behind when they move around, or they release them into the air for those that don't move around, like plants and fungi tend to stay in the one place, but they do release bits of DNA and things into the air. So in recent years, we've been interested in monitoring air quality in cities, for example, looking for pollution and substances that are building up in the atmosphere to potentially dangerous levels because we're worried about our health and what we're breathing in and all of these things. So we've built all these machines that sample the air and filter the air to see what's in it to figure out if there's any toxic pollution, that sort of stuff. But the air filters are so good because they're catching tiny microscopic, sub-microscopic bits of chemical. They're also collecting whatever else is floating around in the air, including stray DNA from living organisms.
Is this like eDNA?
It is eDNA. So in 2023, a paper was published in Nature outlining the use of air pollution filters to capture what they've called eDNA or environmental DNA to identify what species are in a given area. So what they can do is collect the gunk out of an air filter, whatever happens to have been flowing through the air filter as they're monitoring pollution and air quality, and they can take a very small sample and then amplify that sample up using PCR and other methods to get large quantities of DNA, enough that they can sequence the regions that they're looking for to identify. Basically, what they can do is take a biodiversity snapshot from the air in any location if they set up the filters for long enough. So using this method, they have positively identified different taxa of plant, fungi, insects, mammals, birds, fish, amphibians, as well as traces of other phyla like microbial life forms as well. So what you really have to do is know kind of what you might be looking for, and each different phyla, each different taxa has got its own regions that you would look for, regions of the DNA that identify, well, that's going to be, you know, a vertebrate, that's going to be an amphibian, whatever it might be, and they know what they're looking for. But they can identify all of these different things just from the samples that they scrape out of a grotty old air filter, which is pretty amazing.
That's so amazing.
So basically they can keep track of everything that's there down to a species level in any location of all of the living things. Probably the microbes are the less likely ones to show up. And what they've also found is that some organisms are harder to catch the DNA from. So they're not sure if that's because some organisms don't shed DNA as readily as others or what it might be exactly. But if they improve, you know, this technique was based on the idea that you could just scrape it out of an air filter and you'd get what you were looking for. But if they built machines specifically for doing that, I think that's probably as close as we've come to being able to scan for life signs. But it's likely to be a while before some ensign on the bridge can just press a button and make it so. And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science! We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.